right, that is our signal to start our rooster. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Welcome to the show. So glad you're part of it and that you've joined me today. I have a couple of things I want to run by you very quickly here before we get into something more meaty. And the first thing is, I am our whole team at Stand to Reason is a bit bonkers right now because we are, in a good sense, like beyond ourselves with excitement. And I'll tell you why. In August, we gave you a special challenge, and the need that we had, and we've done this a couple of Augusts, this last two, I guess, this is the third time, the need we have is to grow a certain group of people that we call strategic partners, those who are at the heart and the core of our financial foundation at Stand to Reason. And we wanted to build our cadre of partners by 100 people. That's why we call it Be One of the 100, since we're asking God to give us 100 new committed strategic partners. And we you know, added some extra motivation, of course, by offering to send the 9-session 2020 reality conference digital material, and you could give it away or use it yourself, however you wanted to do it. We were praying for 100 new strategic partners, but as I watched the numbers rise during the month of August, well, my hopes began to rise too, because I was thinking, wow, we're doing pretty great here. People are responding. Maybe we'll beat last year's number, which was an astonishing 173. That's like 75% over what we had been praying for. But as it turned out, by the end of August, I could hardly believe it when, you know, so many of you came through. Actually, we added 209 new strategic partners to our community. And that's not all. Our challenge inspired a lot of existing strategic partners to increase their current monthly giving, and still others surprised us by sending in a special individual gift. I mean, I'm just telling you, we have been overwhelmed by your response. It's just like, wow, you know. And two words come to mind for me, and one of them is the thankfulness that I feel to you and also to the Lord, but also how we are humbled. It's hard to describe how when we get something wonderful like that, it actually humbles us. But it does. It lifts our spirits, but it doesn't lift our pride. It humbles us because we are so thrilled to see how God steps in through so many other people who are now expressing their confidence in us by joining up, joining the cadre. And it just, it's humbling, simply to put. You know, we're living in hard times, and it's hard times at home and abroad, as we've witnessed this last month. And so it's especially uplifting to know that in these hard times, as the pressure mounts on us as a Christian community, that we got a lot of people who really care, that are on our side, that are all in, and are there backing us as we visibly stand up in the line of fire, and giving you the tools to stand up in the line of fire in your communities in the way that God has given you opportunity. So I just want to say thank you to each one of the 209 new strategic partners, and to the rest of you who have labored with us so faithfully over the years. You make a massive difference, and without you, Stand to Reason, and the impact that you make through what we're able to do simply would not be possible. So that's just like one great big wow, wow. Shout out there to you wonderful people for responding. Coming up this weekend, now that would be September 11th for me, broadcasting now, so you'll get this on tomorrow, Wednesday. It's now in 3 days. I'm going to be doing a rare appearance in my own community. Calvary Community Church in Westlake is sponsoring a Tactics event, and I don't get to do much too often in my own community. In fact, I'm flying back from Wisconsin, where I am at right now. on Friday just to be there for my event on Saturday, to fly back to Wisconsin on Sunday and keep continue my writing retreat here. So I'm flying back just to do this event. It starts at 9 in the morning, goes to 2 in the afternoon. And even during lunch, which will be provided, I'm going to be engaging in an open Q&A, I think, is what we got planned. So I'm really looking forward to this. I know a lot of these folks. It's a great group of people to meet with. It's my own community. If you are within striking distance in Ventura, in Oxnard, Santa Barbara, maybe, certainly San Fernando Valley, West LA, and you want to make the trip, be there 9 o'clock. Well, you better get there at about 8:30, maybe 8:15, to sign up and get in if you haven't signed up already. We start right at 9 o'clock. We go to 2, and it's all tactics. All right. And if you want to get more of the detail on it, you can just go to the website, calvarywestlake.org. That's calvarywestlake.org. And then scroll down to the bulletin. Punch the bulletin button and then scroll down and you'll see the announcement and a click through. So you could sign up for the event. It gives all the details there. Once again, that's calvarywestlake.org. And then scroll down to the bulletin, and then scroll down from there. You'll see the details. Also, in the same weekend, and Friday evening and Saturday, Women in Apologetics and teamed up with the Center for Biblical Unity is doing a conference also. I actually don't know right where it's located, but you can get all the information on their website. Go to womeninapologetics.com and then go to the calendar. You can do /calendar, and the details are there. But you can do an online version. You could do a live version. I think it's in Southern California. But a few weeks ago, I had Monique Dusson on as my guest. And she is one of our featured speakers for Reality for this season. And the next one's coming up in about 2.5 weeks from now in Southern Cal. I'll tell you about that in just a moment. But she's a specialist in the area of critical race theory. And the theme of this year's conference is doing justice biblically. All right. So they have a whole bunch of different speakers for Friday night and all day Saturday that are going to really focus in on this. And I highly recommend it if you're not going to go to the tactics event that I'm teaching at in Westlake Village in Conejo Valley on Saturday. So just want you to know that that's available as well. womeninapologetics.com, I believe. I'm looking for the details here. womeninapologetics.com and /calendar, and all the details are there. Okay. Mentioned something about Reality, just to give you the numbers. We have been restricted in Southern California for this great event, passing the baton to young people, middle schoolers and junior hires. Whole youth groups come to these events, along with the youth group leaders and a lot of parents and a whole lot of people who just want to hear the details, get the teaching. This year's theme, Chaos to Clarity. Lots of chaos out there, theological chaos, cultural chaos, ethical chaos. We want to bring clarity to you as followers of Christ. So our goal here is to train Christians. Now, if there are non-Christians that want to come, we're glad to have you. But it's not evangelistic. You're going to get a lot of things, hopefully, that annoy you in a good way, that we hope will put a stone in your shoe and get you thinking. But our goal is to train followers of Jesus who are serious about making a difference in the culture. And we have gobs and gobs of young people that have been coming the last few years. We took a hit last year. We're doing really well this year, but because of restrictions in Southern Cal, we can only take 2,000 people. And you might remember from 2019, we had 2,700 in Orange County then. So right now, looking at the numbers in Orange County, we have 1,690 people signed up. That means we have room for about 300 people more. We can only take 1,000 in the gym and 1,000 in the main sanctuary. Those are the limits the state of California has put on us and on Calvary Chapel. So we can't blow the stops out like we thought. If you want to get in, go to realityapologetics.com and sign up for Orange County. In Seattle, Bellevue, October 15, and by the way, the dates, September 24th and 25th, just for the record, in Orange County. in Seattle, October 15th and 16th. We've got 851 people sign up. The goal is about 1,000. We can't fit too many more than that. It means we got another 150 people can sign up. All right. I don't know when they're going to close this event, but we're still, what, 6 weeks, 5 weeks away, and we're almost full. Just saying. RealityApologetics.com. In Dallas, February 25th and 26th. Oh, I missed Minneapolis. Grace Church, Eden Prairie. We got almost 500 people signed up. And what's that? Like 10 weeks out? All right. So get on board if you really want to be part of this. We don't want to leave you out. All right. RealityApologetics.com. And then in Dallas in February 25th to 26th, and Philly, March 25th and 26th. So all of these coming up. Incidentally, we do need volunteers for every event that we're doing this year. If you want to volunteer, you have to contact Kyle. Kyle at, that's K-Y-L-E, Kyle at str.org. And he'll take care of you. Yeah, the same Kyle that's on the other side of the window here running things, helping me do a good show. All right. Now, I want to shift gears here, having covered those items that are really important. And I want to clarify something that I said a number of weeks ago that in my mind got somewhat miscommunicated. Though it seems that there may have been some misinformation that I was passing on as well. I don't know the context at all. I can't recall it. But I had been making reference to the brutal and vicious murder of Matthew Shepard, now almost 20 years ago. The gay man who was beaten and apparently tortured and then strung up on a barbed wire fence and left to die, which he did, and created quite a sensation, partly because of the brutality of the murder and partly because he was a gay man that was murdered. What I said was, it was my understanding that he had been murdered by another gay man, and there had been a lot of things published along that line. Now, we had an astute and gracious, generous listener who sent us some notes and raised the issue about the accuracy of that particular point. That no, this other person wasn't gay. That was a misunderstanding, or that was a rumor or a report that wasn't well substantiated. And he was actually animated by anti-gay sentiments. Now, you need to know two things, first of all. I don't care what motivated the brutal slaying of Matthew Shepard. It was unconscionable to do so. Anyone, for any reason, who takes a valuable human being and does that to them has committed a reprehensible act. Okay? Just for the record. Secondly, I have no horse in this race. I actually don't care what his motivations happen to be. If his motivations were anti-gay motivations, then so be it. If they weren't, then so be it. The motivations to me are not relevant. They were relevant to the press, and that was part of my concern. My concern being that oftentimes the press jumps the gun. And I'm not going to go into particulars here of other examples because that just might create more consternation. But you guys know that there are lots of times when things look one way at first glance, especially when that kind of interpretation fits a very popular narrative that is being aggressively advanced in the culture. And it turns out later, nah, that isn't actually the way it turned out, which is meant to show that the legacy media are not reliable. I was going to say not always reliable, but if you're not reliable, then that means you're always not reliable. It doesn't mean you don't ever tell the truth or don't display things or depict things in an accurate way. But if a person is unreliable, that means you can't rely on them even when they're telling the truth. Now, they may be telling the truth, but how do you know? You trust people who have shown themselves to be trustworthy, and therefore they are reliable, and reliable people you give the benefit of the doubt to. They have earned that. But when you have a press that consistently distorts, and that would be my view, and when I say distorts, I don't mean that they necessarily report falsehoods. They could report true things in a way that distorts the truth. So this is how you can lie by telling the truth. A very simple way, example. You can report only good things about one candidate and only the bad things about another candidate. Now, it may be that everything you reported about either candidate is absolutely true, but you've created a false impression. And the impression is that one candidate is wonderful and the other one is awful simply because of the selectivity of the reporting. This happens all the time. And so I am on my guard regarding those things and am concerned when there is a high visibility crime that's been committed and the press spins it in a particular way, consistent with the narrative, and ignores all kinds of other information that is not consistent with the narrative. That's my general concern about these things. So please understand that. It may have been that I completely misspoke in terms of my understanding of the facts about the Matthew Shepard motivation, the murderer's motivation. Okay, but regardless of the motivation, that does not in any way sanitize the nature of the crime that was committed. And incidentally, saying that I don't care about the motivation underscores something else that I have a strong conviction about, and I don't mind talking about it here. I have actually written about it and talked about it on the air, but not for a long time. I think hate crime legislation is a really bad idea. And it's not because I think hate crimes are good. I think that hate crimes are tantamount, I should say, legislating against hate crimes is tantamount to legislating against thought, and therefore they become thought crimes. Now think about this with me for a moment. If you murder somebody, or let me back off from murder for a moment because that gathers the most extreme penalty all by itself. Let's just say you assault somebody. The assault is actionable. There are laws that address the assault, and there are punishments pertaining to the assault itself, regardless of any person's motivation. However, in the current climate, if the assault is perceived to be motivated by an idea, an attitude, a point of view that is labeled hate, then there is additional punishment that is added. So there is punishment for the assault, which is appropriate, but there is punishment for the thought. And that is not appropriate. And on its own, prima facie, on its face, this is illicit in my view. You cannot make thoughts criminal. You cannot criminalize these things. You cannot punish someone for their attitudes. And there was a time not too long ago where this was so obvious it didn't even need to be spoken, but now it's happening all the time. I'm going to give you maybe later in the show an example of this. This is the cancel culture now. The thought crime legislation came from the top. That's hard totalitarianism, and this is a totalitarian impulse, thought crimes. But now it's coming from our communities, soft totalitarianism. And they're both just as bad, because no one should be punished for their point of view. No one should be punished for their sentiments. No one should be punished for their ideas. Nobody should be punished for their thoughts. Punish the actions, yes, regardless of what motivated them. Ironically, and this is in the piece that I wrote a number of years ago about hate crimes, you can find it on our website, we generally have a sense of what's sympathy is way too strong of a word, but an understanding when a person motivated by some strong emotion commits a crime. Okay, this is the difference between first and second degree murder. They both are murder, but in second degree, the person wasn't lying in wait necessarily. There was a flash of anger and hostility, and bang, they took somebody out. And so there's a sense of understanding that that is not as egregious. But what do we think about a person who kills with impunity and has no emotional connection to the killing at all? I was just reading last night, ironically, about the commandant of Auschwitz. His name was Hess. There's a couple of Hesses, not Rudolf Hess. This was a different Hess. But for 3.5 years, commandant of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And he was ended up being hanged in 1947 at Auschwitz for his crimes there. And the testimony of those who watched the hanging was that he didn't seem the least bit moved by any of it. Certainly not moved by the enormity of his crime. Now, this is a person that we normally would consider a monster. Someone who has no real emotional investment at all. We are somewhat understanding when people commit crimes based on strong emotion like hate. That's why it's so odd to me, while we are increasing the penalty for someone who allegedly was motivated by hate to commit a crime. So in a whole different sense, this is a bit upside down. And it also, you know, there's also the problem of how do you know the person hates? You're trying to infer their thoughts from their actions. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. But do you see how difficult that would be? What ends up happening, though, friends, and this is another liability of so-called hate crime legislation, it isn't legislation against all hate. It is legislation against politically incorrect hate. Only certain types of hate are actionable. Really? Well, isn't there this thing called equal protection under the law? So there are all kinds of problems with hate crime legislation. I think it's wrongheaded and unjust at its base. And it also seems to be inconsistent with our ordinary intuitions about emotion and egregiousness of crimes. And it also seems inconsistent with equality under the law. Yeah, these things are bad in so many ways. Nevertheless, they've gotten traction because people don't like hate. I don't like hate. Please. Oh, man. But my animus against hate and actions motivated by hate does not cloud my judgment on what is sound from a legal point of view, what it is appropriate to punish people for. and hate crimes, alleged hate crimes. I mean, what hate crimes is not a category of crime. It's a category of law. Because there are all kinds of crimes that could be described as hate crimes, crimes motivated by hate. But that's not hate crimes. Hate crimes now are the kind of crime that the law says is motivated by hate and therefore actionable in an increased sense because of the politically incorrect nature of what the law presumes your attitude was when you committed the crime. It protects a certain class of people and not all people from hate. Incidentally, whenever you hear the word hate, this is just no extra charge for this. This is in the category of being alert to nonsense, being alert to shell games, being alert to manipulation. Whenever you hear the word hate being used to describe anyone, nowadays, you can almost always completely dismiss it as a rhetorical flourish. This is the word of choice that people use to demonize any idea or any person they don't like or agree with. Normally, and this is very consistent nowadays, the charge that somebody is being hateful is nothing more than a shallow, empty, vacuous ad hominem. That's all it is. And it's libelous as well, I think, in most cases, because it's not true. The so-called evidence of hate is having the wrong opinion about something. That's the evidence of hate. You have an opinion that there are two genders, which is a scientific fact, if anybody cares about the science. You have the opinion that there are moral dimensions to sexuality. That's hate. That's hate. Just to use two popular examples. So that's a word that should immediately put your antennas up regarding misleading language and rhetorical flourishes. An attempt to make a point without any substance. It is just angry noise. And ironically, often is clearly, if the evidence of the person's behavior who makes this charge is meaningful, that itself seems to be an evidence of hate. Much more than the wrong ideas of the person who is being called hateful. Something to think about. All right, to your calls after this, Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
Did you know there's a new argument that attempts to use frogs to prove that God didn't create only two genders? Find out what that argument is and my response in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Look for it on iTunes, your favorite podcast app, or at the top of the homepage at str.org. The world says you can be a boy or a girl. You can be gay or straight. You can be cis or trans. There's no right or wrong way to define yourself. No one can tell you who you are. You decide who you want to be, and whatever that is, it can change whenever you want. That's because your identity is untethered to reality. It's chaos. But you don't have to listen to the world. You can listen to a different account of who you are, one told by your maker. And this one is anchored to reality and will bring you from chaos to clarity. Don't miss this year's Reality Conference. Go to realityapologetics.com to get dates and locations for the Student Apologetics event of the year.
When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group, helping STR train Christians to confidently and graciously defend their convictions. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our ongoing work. As our thanks for your partnership, we have created some benefits to express our gratitude, like a 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and more. To become a strategic partner, visit str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email Ocean Wilson at ocean@str.org.
All right, friends, Greg Kokel back with you here. And, of course, you just heard Ocean talking about being in a strategic partner. And it's just to let you know, even though the being the 100, be one of the 100 project from last month, which turned out to be one of the 209, wildly successful. We're thrilled about it. It was last month, but we are not closing the door on new strategic partners. So always welcome to have you on board to join that team of Christian workers. All right, let's go to South Jersey and talk with Jeff. Hello, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. Good talking to you again. So I have an interesting situation on my hands. I need someone to hash out. I realized it was a Tuesday, so I decided to call in. I'm not really active on Facebook that much anymore, but I went on, give someone a message, and I saw a friend from elementary school and high school who posted yesterday that their six-year-old girl decided it was a boy, and they went on for paragraphs about it and, you know, affirming the choice, and they've been in the, you know, they're down in Orlando now, and they've been in touch with resources with the LGBT community down there. But at the end, he kind of, the father mentioned, you know, he was open for questions if anyone had them. And we just to preface this, we're not like, we were never insanely close, but we were always like friendly. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure, like, if I should take him up on the offer to, like, communicate with him privately, or if I would, and especially given our situation, if I would just come, I wouldn't know exactly how to approach it, but I don't want to, if the opportunity's there, I want to kind of maybe plant a pebble or a stone or something.
Yeah.
And then,
oh, gosh.
But given that it's his daughter, I wasn't sure if I should even take up the situation because I've just come off like a jerk. If where he's at, he's like too far gone, already. If I had a chance to, you know, talk to him, whenever this started and, you know, I was actually involved with him, not in just an online relationship. And I just wanted to lay it out there and kind of see what you thought.
Yeah, you heard me groan a few moments ago, and I'm groaning because I think this is such a difficult circumstance. And what's difficult, it's difficult in two ways. First of all, this is a very dangerous circumstance for the daughter.
Yeah.
Right? That's one thing. So this is very weighty. And secondly, there is a tsunami of resistance against anyone that would suggest other than supporting this, what they would consider transgender identity. Okay, so this just in general, this is what you're up against. All right. Okay, so that's why I'm groaning. Okay, secondly. All things considered, I think you're right, with the exception of one thing I'll mention in a moment. But all other things considered, I think you're right. It looks like this person is already very committed to this course of action, this father for his daughter, okay? And they've contacted the LGBT crowd. They've gone public on Facebook with their sentiments, which they are probably going to get all kinds of strokes from their friends.
And also other friends and stuff. It's kind of sad to see. I just a little excursus here. Like, I became a Christian in 1992, and I kind of knew that society was, like, you know, it on the downgrade. But it's kind of like, in the last 10 or so years, it's kind of been like almost breathtaking to to see. And it's like really hard, you know. I don't know what like a new Christian or like a teenager thinks, but like for someone, you know, I'm in my mid 40s or something. I don't want to be desensitized to it. And it's just like, it when you see someone, you know, like do this, it's like you see like society, like,
you're right. It rattles you. Okay, so let me offer this additional thought that I mentioned. Everything looks pretty bleak, and like this ship has already sailed. However, he did say something at the end where he's open to hear other people. Now, that is a huge door that he has opened.
Yeah.
Maybe he's only unlocked it. Maybe it's just slightly ajar. It's hard to know how committed he is to that, but nevertheless, it's an invitation. And I think in light of that, since you asked kind of thing, you should take advantage of it. And part of the reason is there are not going to be, and I'll offer you a thought of what to recommend here, but there you are not this, your friend, I'm just going to call him Fred, okay? Fred is not going to get probably anybody else that's going to give him the information that I want to suggest that you give to him, first off, even Christians, because there may be other Christians just like you. They're going, oh, well, I don't know. You're willing to take a step, but a lot of them are just going to say this is a lost cause, or they're just not going to make themselves vulnerable to the attack of those people who would say, who would come after you for making an alternate recommendation. But think about this, all right? You don't know this person very well, right? You're not like super close.
We're not super close, though.
Right, okay. And so his community on Facebook is not your community, correct?
We have some mutual friends.
Mutual
close friends. But,
okay,
yeah.
The point that I'm getting to is this is not going to cost you much. If it goes completely south, it doesn't cost you much. You don't even have to read the comments if you don't want to, which are going to be really bad.
I was going to message him privately.
Oh, well, that would be one thing. Okay, you can. There are two sides to that issue, because I'm thinking there may be a possibility of influencing other people who are looking in who are afraid to speak up. Okay, for one. That's a possibility.
Well,
if he asked,
wrinkle. I kind of because Facebook became too much of a time suck. I promised my wife not to be on it, like and active on it. So
yeah. Okay. Well, fine.
Have a conscience. So that's why I was going to go the private.
I
still use it for private messaging, but that's about it.
Sure. Well, look, you could basically keep your promise under this circumstance.
Yeah.
Instead of privately messaging him, you could just message him on the website. Now, this is up to you. It's your decision. I'm saying if you don't go public with it, just with him, then he can respond privately. If you go public, well, now you're making your point to a whole bunch more people, and some of those people are going to get really mad at you. Never mind. Just turn it off and don't go back to that thing. Don't read it.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
But it could have a salutary effect on somebody else. So you talk to your wife and you weigh that out. But here's what I would suggest. I am saying something to this effect. Fred, I read with interest your news about your daughter. And frankly, it really concerns me, the direction you're going. I care about your daughter's well-being, and I do not think this is going to be good for her for a number of reasons. And then you could mention that the attempted suicide rate for people, even who transgender, is like 25 times the national average. This is not good. Okay. And not only that, secondly, Secondly, and by the way, it's not because, you know, Christians are making them feel bad, because in Sweden it's the same statistics and they don't have that dynamic there or total right. acceptance. We're not going to have you get into a big deal, but you just make a couple of points. And the second point is many of these, especially the girls, change their mind in a few years, but they have done irreversible damage to their bodies.
The book, the Abigail Schreier book.
Right? Yes, okay, and that was the other. Yeah. So I'm suggesting that you express your concern and your care and your, you know, basically your love for them. You're not kind of shutting them out, calling them names. You're saying, I'm really concerned. I don't think this is a good decision. The suicide rate is really high, even when there's a lot of acceptance. Secondly, this damage that can be caused cannot be reversed, even when the women especially change their mind further down. Okay, and this kid is what? I'm looking at 6 years old, for goodness sake.
6 years old,
What does a 6 year old know about herself? Please, anyway.
Well, yeah, the only thought that came in my head would have been, like, as nicely as possible, say, like, when she told you she was a boy, like, what does the word boy even mean?
Right.
You know, it's like you don't even the father, like, can't define boy.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right, because the word means it refers to a sex. There isn't a boy frame of mind or whatever. We're not going to get into that, though, because I have one other thought. And you mentioned Abigail Schreier's book, Irreversible Damage. I have not read it. Amy has. She says it's magnificent. I would recommend that he, before he makes any final decisions, in order to make an informed decision, mm-hmm. he read this book. Now, you can even let him know, this book has been pilloried by the left, and Schreier has been called all kinds of nasty names. Okay? Tell him just ignore that and read the book. Draw his own conclusions. Don't let the LGBT crowd tell you, Fred, what to think about this book.
Right.
It is done by a careful author. It's carefully written, and it has gotten broad acclaim from those who are not inclined to champion a particular cause. And so I just encourage him, please read this. Please read it before you make an irreversible decision, because that's what's going to happen here, especially with girls. They get, you know, male hormones. They get, this is just a six-year-old. I don't know they've got a long time before this starts that part, adolescence kind of kicks in. Please have him read the book. And so your whole appeal is, I care about you. There's another side to this you must be aware of, at least. Then you make your own decision. But don't let group people shut you off from both sides of the story. That's the kind of appeal I encourage you to make.
I appreciate that. I could definitely use your audience's prayers in the next day or two. So,
okay. So, folks, that's Jeff from South Jersey and what he's facing. And to think that they are a six-year-old. Oh, my
God. It's
heartbreaking. A six-year-old.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. Jeff, thanks so much for the call. And I'd be interested in a follow-up call once this pans out, okay?
Well, if I'm not in the gulag in a couple of weeks, I'll try to do that.
Okay, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah, take care. It just boggles my imagination. It just, when I think of my own daughters when they were six. By the way, this isn't utterly strange that kids can be confused, especially when they get to adolescence. But what we have in the culture now is an incentive to encourage them towards an unhealthy direction. Everybody in this discussion admits that something is wrong. There is a disconnect between a person's physical body and their self-perception. But what what many people are saying is that the body is wrong and the mind is right at the moment, instead of saying, no, the body's just fine. Maybe it's the mind that's confused, and there's lots of reasons that could be the case. Developmental reasons, issues, of family and growing up. There's also this trend called rapid onset gender dysphoria, ROGD. By the way, I heard a review of Abigail Schreier's book that just completely dismissed it because, as they said, there's not a shred of evidence for ROGD. In other words, that rapid onset gender dysphoria is a social contagion. It's a fad, is what she's saying. Oh, there's not one shred of medical evidence. It's not a medical condition, sir. It is a sociological condition, which is what she's citing. And it's the sociological pressures that are encouraging people to move in this direction, especially when they get so applauded when they do. And if anyone objects and raises the appropriate alarm, those people get canceled. My goodness. Now, we're supposed to do a break, but I'm looking at the clock, and I got Dave in Gig Harbor here. And if I come back after break, I'll give him the short shrift. So I'm just going to go to Dave right now. We'll skip the break there, Kyle@SDR.org. That's the guy you contact if you want to complain about the radio show. I mean, if you want to volunteer for a rethink. I mean, realities. Anyway, here we go. Dave, Gig Harbor, Washington. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg.
Hey.
Hi, Greg. I have a question about a tactic for defending inerrancy, which may not be the best tactic, but I thought I'd run it past you and see what
sure.
you thought, if that's okay. Okay. When I say inerrancy, of course, I mean inerrancy for the original manuscripts.
Right.
I'm not talking about inerrancy for any of the current modern translations. But when a person arguing against inerrancy says, well, you believe in inerrancy? And we say, yes, I do. And they say, well, then do you believe? And then they will pick examples from both the Old and New Testament and say, uh-huh. you don't follow those. And then they're right. I don't. Most churches don't. They don't.
By the way, just for clarification, they don't follow Old Testament things like the Old Testament law. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, but it's New Testament, too. Because
okay, I know, but I just want to be clear. When they say the Old Testament, they are probably referring to Levitical law that we don't follow.
Right.
Is that, okay,
but
good. I just to be clear, go ahead and finish up, though, because I know where this is going, and I've actually done some writing on this, and this is not a hard issue to deal with, but I'll go ahead and finish your thoughts.
Okay, well, let me finish it up.
Sure.
Then we say this tactic says, well, okay, but that was cultural back then, say the New Testament was cultural for braided hair to mean thus and such, and culturally women couldn't speak in church. And then if we say that to them, if we mention culture, that opens the door for them to turn around and say, well, that's fine, I agree with you, but culturally we're different now too. And then they fill in the blank for whatever they want, which
right.
could include things that we don't accept at all.
Yes. And so
like
this is why...
gay marriage, all that.
Right. And I'm looking at the clock, so that's why I'm jumping in a little here, because I want to give you a good answer for this. And this is why we have to be careful when we argue that way. Okay? There is also a misunderstanding, I think, about inerrancy here. Inerrancy doesn't mean that everything that was ever commanded to any person in the Bible is incumbent on every other person reading the inerrant Bible to do. Jesus told Peter, cast your net on the deep side. Okay, was Jesus speaking inerrantly there? I mean, that was the God-man, right? Well, yes. Okay, was Peter obliged to take that literally and do what Jesus said? Yes. Does that mean we have to cast our nets on the outside? No. It was intended for a very particular circumstance. So when you say, well, there was a cultural situation that was being addressed there, We are not saying that the Bible is not inerrant. We are saying that the inerrant scripture was applied in a limited way under those circumstances. And then we ought to be able, and this is really key here, we ought to be able to articulate why we think there was a set of limited circumstance or circumstances that limited the application of that principle. Okay? We aren't just simply saying, well, people had cultural beliefs then that they were supposed to keep, but now we have a different culture, and therefore that leaves us open to the challenge that you cited. And that challenge a lot of times has to do with sexual behaviors. Well, now we have a different view about homosexuality. No. When you go back to the text, you realize that when the text is speaking about sex, it is not speaking about some restricted cultural circumstance. There is no reason to believe that. Just like there's no reason to believe that when Jesus says, you know, I give you a new commandment, love one another, that he was just talking to those disciples in the upper room there and he didn't mean that for us. So there I'm using kind of their verse against them. No, we are acknowledging that different commands are given under different circumstances, and we're doing our best to figure out what the appropriate intention of the author was regarding those commands and how broad their application is. Incidentally, the reason I asked about the Old Testament is there is no obligation of any Gentile to keep any provision of the Mosaic Law simply in virtue of it being in the Mosaic Law. That law is a contract between God and Jews, period. Period.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes, just like in our laws, there's no obligation for a person in Illinois to obey the law in California if he's not in California. It's a different group, a different set of circumstances. However, California has homicide statutes, and so does Illinois have homicide statutes. Why? Because the homicide issue is not just kind of a partisan state's rights issue. This is the kind of thing that applies to all human beings because of the gravity of it. And sometimes you're going to find some of those things in the Mosaic Law. But those things are repeated in other places like the New Testament. And most of the Ten Commandments, in my view, all of them, save one, that being the Sabbath, are like that. These are universals that are in every law. But we are not obliged to keep that because it's in the Mosaic Law. We're obliged to keep it because it's a universal moral good. Prohibition of a moral harm.
I see what you're saying, and that's a good insight, and I appreciate that. I'm going to look into that more. Is there any books on this that you could recommend?
Well, one of the pieces I referred to, there are books on hermeneutics. You know, you can get whole tomes on those. You know, Reading for the Bible for All It's Worth is one book on hermeneutics. And there are others. That's a popular one. But, you know, most of the time we just have to pay attention to the text. And what I've told you so far will get you a long way. Even when the text is meant to be taken literally in the circumstance that we find any particular verse, and even if all of the texts are divinely inspired, we assert that, we stipulate that, that doesn't mean that every single verse that is meant to be taken literally and inspired by God in the circumstances to which it applies equally in every circumstance. It just doesn't mean that. This is where, looking more closely at the text, we have to, you know, parse it and divide the word aright, as it were. Paul says, study to show yourself approved, a workman who does not need to be ashamed, handling accurately the word of truth. Now, that's in 2 Timothy chapter 2. But the point that he's making has to do with looking closely at the text and realizing we have different kinds of writing in the scriptures applied to different sets of circumstances and different people. And so we need to be more judicious than we often are in taking a look at what is the appropriate application. The big point here, the takeaway for you, Dave, in Gig Harbor, which is a cute little town there in Washington. I've been there many times.
Yeah, we're going to see you in October up in Seattle.
Too. Oh, okay, good. That's right close to where my my sister lives. But you know, I'm losing my train of thought. The big takeaway here is that, no worries, it's my fault. The big takeaway here is that just because the scripture is inspired doesn't mean that every verse has the same application to every situation. If we are going to argue for a limited application, we have to make the case. And that would be true for some of the verses that you mentioned, or some of the passages or concepts that people want to advance now in a popular way, like the idea of culture's change towards sex. Well, culture may have changed, but the text that we cite where God instructs about sex, it's clear that those things haven't changed because they go right back to the creation order. And the kinds of prohibitions regarding that are universals, obviously. They're not like whether you eat shellfish or not, for goodness sake. That was for the Jews.
Or get it wasn't a tattoo.
That has a different cultural background, I think. Because I thought that people getting tattoos back then were getting tattoos as spirit fetishes or as idolatry fetishes. It wasn't just making a mark on your skin. It was what that meant in that circumstance. That doesn't mean the same thing in most cases nowadays. So therefore, the issue wasn't the tattoo. It was what the tattoo represented. But see, that's an interpretive element, all right? And the more you know about the culture and stuff, the better you're at going to be at interpreting things. However, the point here, though, you can't just look at it in the Bible and say, if you don't practice it now, you don't believe it's inspired. It's simple as that. Dave, gotta let you go. Thank you for the call, and I'm glad we got a chance to talk about that a little bit. That's it for this hour, friends. Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye.